This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a range of in-depth updates.
We cover Lynn Stewart, judgments in the RNC, Republican National Convention cases from 2004, the transfer of Omar Khadr from Guantanamo to Canada, and the latest news on Julian Assange.
We'll hear about recent arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. It concerns whether corporations can be held liable in the United States courts for violations of international human rights law.
Corporations are people when it comes to donating lots of money to the candidates. Are they people when it comes to killing others? Can they be prosecuted like human beings?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, 8 years after the 2004 RNC in New York City, we're still getting decisions from the many lawsuits that were filed, including many by guild members. One recent case involved the concept of mass probable cause. The protesters won summary judgment on the unconstitutionality of police arrests that took place during a march on Fulton Street. Other protesters lost their summary judgment argument for a protest that took place in Union Square. Do you want to describe what summary judgment is, Michael?
What I gather from you, Heidi, is that the issue is whether there's such a thing as mass probable cause. And what the protesters were saying is that you cannot arrest hundreds of us at once on the grounds that there's a group mass probable cause being that the group of us are reasonably considered to be committing a crime. There's a reasonable basis to argue that we're committing a crime. What they argued was that's not, you can't do that. There has to be individual probable cause that each one of us, there's a reasonable basis for believing that we're in the act of committing a crime. And what the police did here was just round up 400 or some people saying mass probable cause. And when they made a motion for summary judgment, what the protesters were saying is we don't even need a trial on this. The facts are not in dispute. You rounded up 400 or 500 of whatever the number of people by claiming that we all were in the act of committing a crime. That can't be. And my understanding is the decision was what on that issue, Heidi?
The decision, there were two protests in discussion here. One was Fulton Street, and they're the ones where the judge said there is no question of fact. They were given contradictory instructions by police, and they weren't given an opportunity to disperse right before police arrested nearly 230 of them. So in that case, there was no mass probable cause. Now, on the protests that took place on 16th Street, right on the north side of Union Square, the judge found that there were what he said open questions of fact as to whether police properly culled those who were violating the law from innocent bystanders when police shut down the street between Union Square and Irving Place and arrested some 400 people, which I would call a pretty clear trap and arrest scenario. And in fact, during that RNC, I was in one of those trap and arrests. They got people between a city block and they blocked it off so you couldn't leave. And then later they arrest people. So, but on that particular one, the judge didn't find summary judgment.
You know, the decisions are generally, I think, going in our favor on
yeah.
these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But what's outrageous about it is, as I know you sort of reflected on when you said how old these cases are, 8 years ago, these arrests were made. And the effect of the arrests should not be underestimated. These were mass protests going on in New York. Many, if not most of the people were doing nothing that should have warranted their arrest. But in fact, they just wanted to get protesters off the street. The Republican mayor of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, putting in the Republican convention in New York, just said basically, I think, to his people, get them off the streets. And then when they got them off the streets, they would hold them in what we called Guantanamo on the Hudson, which was a big old warehouse on the Hudson River. So what you had was essentially lawless city destroying the First Amendment rights to mass protest. And here you and I are, Heidi, 8 years later discussing these victories. But in the end, the city got its way.
The city got its way. The city made a calculated decision beforehand, taking out insurance policies, as we know they do in all cities where they're going to have national special security events such as this. They made a decision that they didn't want the protesters in the eyes of the mass media. And you're absolutely right, Michael. They then engaged in a very rash series of mass arrests. 1,800 people were arrested during those 4 days. And as a result, there were over 500 lawsuits, including a class action, over specifically this issue, the lack of probable cause by police who engaged in what we know are unlawful arrests where essentially it's guilt by association. And they want to get people off the street. And they did it. And I'm afraid that the Bloomberg administration's record on First Amendment activities has been deplorable.
Right. They did it. They got the people off the street. And here we are litigating it 8 years later. And then, as I recall, you know, some of our other guild lawyers tried to get those people out of jail in the required time. The required time in New York City is 24 hours. You can't hold a person for over 24 hours without bringing them before a judge, setting bail, and in this case, obviously, you'd release almost all of them. But instead, they held them in what we call this Guantanamo on the Hudson for 3 or 4 days during essentially the entire duration of the Republican National Convention so they could, one, get people off the streets, and two, send a message to protesters. You protest, you're going to go to Guantanamo on the Hudson. You're not going to see this protest.
And during those days, you know, we had guild lawyers and many others filing what's called writ of habeas corpuses, you know, often at midnight to get those people out. And the judge even ordered the city to release them, and the city didn't.
Right. Writs of habeas corpus were granted by the judges,
right,
and the city refused to obey them.
Right. I mean, how brazen is that?
So we have a lawless situation, and yes, we're picking up a few pieces and winning some victories, but in the end, what the city got here was a city in which protest was much diminished because of its illegal actions.
And which the interests of delegates came first.
Heidi, what else is new?
Michael, we've talked a lot about Department of Homeland Security, so-called fusion centers. These are a national network of offices across the country that were created after the 9/11 attacks, basically to come up with a way for local, state, and federal authorities to share information about prospective terrorist threats. And I must say, I'm not surprised that Senate investigators have just finished a 2-year examination of fusion centers. And let's be clear, almost $1.5 billion have been poured into these centers. And guess what their findings are? That fusion centers have really done nothing to make us safer.
Heidi, go back for a second. Fusion centers are where they combine, like, state and federal officials in their various regional places. Like, are there a
lot
of these?
Right. There's 77.
Oh, and is that many?
Yeah. And
oh, my God.
77. And I just have to quote this because the report calls them pools of ineptitude, waste, and civil liberties intrusions.
This is the Senate of the United States?
Yeah. It's a 141-page report by the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Pools of ineptitude.
Once in a while, maybe it's like a million monkeys at the typewriter, the Senate says something decent. This time, pool of ineptitude is a good one.
The document reports in part on the expenditures that have done nothing to help share intelligence. They have shirt button cameras, $6,000 laptops and big screen TVs. One center spent $45,000 on a decked out SUV that a city official used for commuting. This is fraud, Michael.
It is fraud. And when you consider the poverty in this country right now, and the effort of putting back the payroll tax, and you see this kind of fraud, it's outrageous. But of course, I think for you and I, the idea that we have these 77 fusion centers made up of local and state and federal police looking at all of us and not accomplishing anything and violating our rights is really outrageous.
I just want to say a couple more things on this. Of course, after this report came out, the Department of Homeland Security condemned it. They said that Senate investigators relied on out-of-date data. And they also said that the investigators did not understand the role of fusion centers. What I'm concerned about, Michael, aside from the gross expenditure problems, is the issue of safety. Because Fusion centers have processed over 22,000 what they called suspicious activity reports, SARs, that have then in turn triggered 1,000 federal inquiries or investigations. Now, this to me is a massive waste of time and really a diversion of things like, I would say, monitoring the ports, improving the horrendous situations in airports where we have, in many cases, I'm sorry to say, incompetent, poorly trained and supervised individuals. You know, I went to the airport a few weeks ago. They did not even look at my ID after I waited in line. In two different places, I was whisked through without looking at the picture on my identification card.
The whole thing is a joke, and here's my latest story on that, and then we can move on. I was with a friend at the airport the other day, and we were coming back from another trip. And when he came back, they look in his bag, and they find a small knife that he had, did not know he had, and they took it away from him. But we were coming back. What he said to me is that he brought the knife with him when he went. So essentially, a knife got through without any trouble. And this is just this is just a friend of mine.
Yep.
The whole situation is obviously out of hand.
Michael, we have three short updates that have a common thread. Basically, what happens to individuals when they're held in U.S. custody, and obviously political inmates.
The first of the cases I want to talk about is Omar Khadr. He was 15 years old at the time he was captured by the United States in Afghanistan. He was taken to Guantanamo. And finally, just last week, he was sent to Canada. He's a citizen of Canada, where he will do another 6 years. But there's a number of interesting and distinctive things about his case. First of all, he was 15 at the time of his capture. His father had been killed in the same, quote, firefight. They captured Omar Khadr, 15, and of course at 15 you're a child soldier, if you're a soldier at all, and the absolute requirement in law, including in the United States, is that you be rehabilitated, not imprisoned, that you don't get mixed with other people, and you get rehabilitated. Instead, they take Omar Khadr to Guantanamo. They don't treat him as the child that he is, and in fact, they torture him. And there's a video that people can watch on the web of him in his cell, it's in black and white, crying for his mother when he's about 15 or 16. You can't watch it without just saying, what is this country that we live in doing? What is it doing?
And they kept him there for 10 years. He faces another six.
They kept him there for 10 years. At the eighth year, in 2010, he finally pleaded guilty. Now, I don't think he was guilty of anything. It's disputed about whether he even threw the grenade that supposedly killed this Marine or whoever. Secondly, he was 15. Thirdly, it was in a, quote, firefight, and these two people were like opposing forces against each other. So that's crazy, but he essentially was forced to plead guilty in 2010. He pled to an 8-year sentence in which he was only supposed to serve 1 year more at Guantanamo and then 7 in Canada, but the Canadians never wanted him back at all. And so they refused to take him back, even though they had agreed that he would come back. The right-wing government in Canada, the conservative government, said we're not taking him back. Finally, for whatever reasons, after 2 years instead of 1 year, he's back in Canada in a maximum security facility where he will be up for parole next year, but will he get out? Considering the Canadian attitude so far, I'm not sure it's likely. But so you look at it, 15 years old, tortured, Guantanamo, crime he may not have committed, forced to plead guilty, Canadians won't defend their own citizen, and now this child soldier is sitting in a prison. All again about, as you said in the opening theme, the conditions that the U.S. is holding people under, and what the U.S. has become in the world in terms of imprisonment and human rights. And the second case is that of five people who have been fighting extradition from the United States since at least 2004.
And where are they being held?
Those five are being held in England, and they've been fighting extradition to the United States. The ones that people may have heard of are Bachmar Ahmed and Abu Hamza. Those are two of the five. They took their extradition case all the way through the UK courts. They then went to the European Court of Human Rights, and incredibly, they lost. I read that decision at the European Court of Human Rights, and you have to say that court has nothing to do with human rights. And we talked about that decision on this show if people want to go back and find it. But that's the one where they said that, well, even solitaire for 23 hours a day, long term, is not torture, doesn't violate the European Convention, and it's wrong to say they can't communicate with each other or with the outside world, or with other people, with other inmates, because they can talk through the ventilation system. Crazy.
Now, let's be clear. These individuals are in custody right now in the UK. If they come to the U.S., they'll also be in custody.
Right. The biggest claim here is that when they're brought to the U.S., the custody will be one that is cruel and inhuman treatment or torture. And that's
an extraordinary rendition, in effect.
Essentially right, without necessarily being waterboarded. To put some substance on that, is the UN rapporteur, special rapporteur for torture, Juan Mendez, who himself was tortured in the Argentinian Dirty War, issued a statement last week saying that he feared that if these people are sent to the United States, these five from the United Kingdom, that they will be tortured. What
were their crimes to start with, Michael?
Well, they haven't been convicted of anything, so they're alleged to whatever. I don't know. I mean, it's not even the issue. It's not they haven't been convicted. But what Juan Mendez says is the UN Convention Against Torture states you cannot extradite or deport someone to a place if he or she would be tortured. Again, this is Juan Mendez, the UN rapporteur on torture. Here's what Juan Mendez says. I think there is a very good argument that solitary confinement and SAMs, special administrative measures, which impose severe restrictions on communication with other inmates or the outside world, would constitute torture and prevent the UK from extraditing these men. Mendez went on to say, for 22 to 23 hours a day, they look at a wall with no meaningful social contact with anybody. Perhaps 1 hour a day they exercise. Nothing the person can do to alleviate his isolation. It's completely arbitrary. It's imposed whether they behave or they don't. It's a penalty before they're judged. When solitary, and this is quoting him, when solitary confinement is indefinite and prolonged, the psychological abuse suffered can be very severe. And Heidi, where do you think they're going to be sent? Expected to be detained at ADX Florence in Colorado.
Maximum security facility where there are many political prisoners.
That aren't even extradited, that are just there. And in fact, in front of the European court, they put in evidence on behalf of these people, look what's happening to people at ADX. Despite that, they're being extradited. And of course, to his credit, Juan Mendez says, this is torture.
And then when they get here, Michael, I'm afraid that the American public is really unaware of what's happening. They just are disappearing into these torture holes.
I'm afraid that's right, Heidi. How many are there now? Again, going to the third case, and I may have a fourth one even, but a third case where the U.S. record now on detaining and torturing people is basically making it impossible for them to maybe get people they want to get, or at least much harder, but certainly getting human rights groups around the world to cry out. Julian Assange, of course, my client and the center's client, is resisting any possible extradition to the United States on the ground.
No, he's still in Great Britain.
Yes, Julian Assange is still in the embassy in Ecuador fighting extradition to Sweden, but really fighting not that extradition as much as his legitimate fear that he will be sent to the United States and put in conditions like those these five people from the UK might be put in at ADX Florence.
I want to ask you what might sound like a far-fetched question, but have we ever heard of an instance when an individual is seeking refuge in an embassy and the local government or even agents of the United States go in and try to extract that person?
No, but that was the threat with Julian Assange, that the UK made the threat to try and get Julian Assange out of the embassy in Ecuador. And there was such an outcry that the OAS itself condemned that and said, you can't do that, and Britain backed off. So now Julian Assange is in the Ecuadorian embassy. He's waiting for some kind of way we can somehow get him to Ecuador or get him to Sweden with a guarantee from Sweden that he won't be extradited to the United States.
But I thought Sweden was vacillating on that topic.
We don't know yet with Sweden. Sweden has so far said no, that they won't either question him in the UK, which his lawyers have said you could do. And Sweden has not yet been willing to guarantee that Julian Assange will not be sent to the United States. Now, in all this, we now bring back to the theme of what imprisonment in the United States means. Think about this. Amnesty International, not Amnesty UK, not Amnesty Sweden, but the big umbrella Amnesty, issued a statement supporting Julian Assange. And here was the reason they said it. And I'll quote it. Amnesty International believes that the forced transfer of Julian Assange to the United States in the present circumstances would expose him to a real risk of serious human rights violations, possibly including violation of his right to freedom of expression, in other words, persecuting him because of what he's done as the publisher of WikiLeaks, and the risk that he may be held in detention in conditions which violate the prohibition of torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. That's Amnesty International. So now you have Omar Khadr, who's finally in Canada after being tortured in U.S. detention in Guantanamo. You have the five, Bahar Ahmed and the four others from the U.K., who are about to be extradited to the United States, having lost most of their appeals, on the grounds that they will be tortured in the United States prison by being subjected to solitary, etc., which Juan Mendez, the U.N. rapporteur, has confirmed. And now you have AI in the international AI saying, don't send him to the United States. He will be tortured.
So taken all together, this marks, from a public relations and sort of worldwide perspective of the United States, an enormous sea change in how we are looked on in terms of human rights violations. We are no longer a guardian of the human rights.
I mean, whether we ever were a guardian is unclear to me, Heidi, or not unclear. I don't think we ever really were. We at least had the claim that we had certain values we would live up to and were therefore the guardians and tried to impose that on the rest of the world, etc. But in this case, that's just rubbish now. Even the claim that we might have one day been a guardian is just rubbish, because we're courts all over the world, including Amnesty and human rights groups, are saying this is just the load up, you know. As a last note on that, the only positive thing we've seen, and we have discussed this case before, the case of Abu Omar, who was kidnapped on the streets of Milan. We interviewed the man who wrote the book about
the kidnapping. A kidnapping in Milan.
23 CIA agents were convicted a year ago, of the kidnapping. 22 CIA agents, I think, and an Air Force soldier. And they were given 7 years, and the CIA station chief was given 9 years. The trials were held in absentia, which means they weren't there, and they're not in Italy now. But that sentencing and that trial and their convictions were just upheld last week by the highest court in Italy, which means those 22 agents and military person can't go to Europe anymore at all, period.
But they won't do time in the U.S.
They won't do time in the U.S., that's for sure. And what their lawyers said, their Italian lawyers said, this is a complete defeat for us. And what we fear now is Italy will ask for their extradition from the United States to Italy, where they can serve their sentence. So now you have a situation where 23 Americans have been sentenced to 7 years, and in the case of the station chief, 9 years. What the defendants now fear, and what their lawyers said they fear,
and the defendants, let's be clear, are the CIA agents who were convicted.
That's correct. They were convicted. They're the defendants. What their lawyers fear is that the Italian government will now be obligated, which it is, to ask for their extradition, the extradition of the 23 U.S. officials, CIA agents and a military person, from the United States to Italy so they can serve their time in Italy. And, of course, Italy is obligated to do that from the Italian legal point of view. But will they do it? I think it's unlikely. Will the U.S. ever extradite one of its CIA agents for the kidnapping of the Muslim cleric Abu Omar on the streets of Milan? Never. Never in our lifetime, Heidi. So now you have this situation where they put Omar Khadr into Guantanamo. They're going to put the five Muslims extradited from the UK or who will be extradited into Florence ADX. They'd put Julian Assange there as well as they got him. And the fourth guy, Abu Omar, they sent to Egypt for torture. So you have a really terrible situation. As I said, the only bright spot is Italy has now upheld the convictions.
It's a bright spot, but in many ways it's a symbolic spot, because if they're not incarcerated,
right, at least
they haven't really found justice.
At least they can't go to the Roman Forum and talk to dead Caesars.
Michael, in 1967, as you well know, Che Guevara was murdered. You and Michael Smith have written a book about it. And this week, we're actually marking the anniversary of that event.
Yes, Heidi, I'm glad you reminded our listeners about this. It's the 45th anniversary of Che's murder at the hands of the Bolivians and the U.S. as well. They pursued him. They went after him, and then even after he was taken prisoner, they executed him in what is a clear war crime. As we've talked about on this program, our book, which has only been out a few months, Killing Che.
The book is called Who Killed Che?
Okay. All right, Heidi, you got me on that one. You know my book title better than I do. Anyway, it's called what again?
Who Killed Che?
All right, so I.
And you and Michael, we should remind listeners, did a lot of research over the years, obtained a lot of documents about this, and have written a book that has been very well received, and I know the Cubans loved it.
Right. The story, of course, that the U.S. put out is that although there were CIA agents on the scene at the time, that there was nothing they could do to stop the Bolivians from murdering Che. The documents we got through a Freedom of Information Act and other sources demonstrate clearly that the United States government wanted him killed. And even though he was a prisoner, he was shot within a day of his capture. So this week, we do remember the 45th anniversary of the death of Che Guevara, considered and deemed to be a heroic guerrilla in Cuban history. Heidi, we've covered the plight and the imprisonment of Lynn Stewart a number of times on this show. We've interviewed Lynn. We've had her in our studio. She's an incredibly remarkable lawyer. But unfortunately, she's in prison, and she's been trying to appeal a very long sentence, 10 years. Can you give us an update on where that is going right now?
Michael, we learned a week or so ago that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has turned down Lynn Stewart's request for a reconsideration on what listeners may recall was actually a second sentence, a much harsher sentence than Judge Codal, who heard her case, initially imposed. He gave her, I think it was a year and a half.
24 months
that would include time served. The government came back to him and said, essentially, this isn't harsh enough. You have to reconsider. They criticized his decision, a decision that was based in part on a volume, hundreds of letters that clients, friends, and colleagues wrote on behalf of Lynn, attesting to her many contributions, really in the field of what we might call poverty law, defending those who traditionally don't get the kind of defense that they really need. And Judge Codal then sentenced her, in what many of us thought was really a travesty of justice, to 10 years, given her health, her age, the body of her work. She's in a medical facility in Texas, and on hearing the news that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals rejected her request, she wrote of a favorite line of Edna St. Vincent Millay's sonnet, "Pity me that the heart is slow to learn what the quick mind beholds at every turn." And the next step in this case will be the Supreme Court of the United States. The defense has 90 days to petition the Supreme Court to take the case, and obviously it has to be based on the issues raised on appeal. which includes what she calls the sentencing fiasco, a sad turn of events for really a feisty spirit who has, we've heard, helped a lot of women in the facility she's in as a jailhouse lawyer, and I think she's been actually subjected to some retaliatory action because of her assistance.
I mean, Lynn is someone who doesn't give up, so I'm sure she has her fighting spirit intact in prison, but it is an outrageously long sentence of 10 years. The conviction was already outrageous, as we have reminded our people that the conduct she was alleged to have done was done under
Janet Reno, under the Clinton administration, and they just gave her a slap on the wrist, said don't do it again. It was essentially not a criminal act. It was a procedural administrative violation by, she was forced to sign what are called special administrative measures, saying she would act in a certain way in her representation of the so-called blind sheikh. And Reno didn't see fit to do anything other than to caution her not to do it again. Yet Ashcroft comes in under Bush, and they made
after 9/11.
After 9/11, he appeared on the Letterman show in a highly unusual move, announcing the indictment of Lynn. Really held her up as an example, we think, of warning to progressive lawyers who might want to represent individuals who speak out against government policies.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Last week, the United States Supreme Court heard argument on the important question of whether corporations, foreign corporations, could be held liable in U.S. courts for violations of international human rights. The case, Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, was brought by the families of seven Nigerians who were executed by a former military government for protesting Shell's oil drilling in the Nigerian Delta. We've discussed the Alien Tort Statute, the statute under which these corporations should be liable, with past guests, including the two attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who won the landmark decision saying that corporations should be liable in 1981. We also will discuss another international case, this one going the other way. This one deciding whether courts in Spain can hold liable torturers from the United States, such as Rumsfeld and others. To talk more about these cases, we're joined by Catherine Gallagher, Senior Staff Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Welcome, Katie, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the landmark case Kiobel v. Royal Dutch Petroleum. That essentially will decide if corporations can be held liable in U.S. courts for violations of international human rights law. Can you give us a brief overview of the case, the facts, and what the implications will be?
Sure. The Kiobel case has been in U.S. courts since 2004. It was brought as a class action, by a group of Nigerians who have moved to the United States as refugees, all of whom have residence in the U.S. They're bringing this case against Royal Dutch Petroleum Shell for its complicity in egregious human rights violations that happened in the Niger Delta in Nigeria in the mid-1990s. These plaintiffs have brought claims of crimes against humanity, torture, arbitrary detention, extrajudicial killing, some of the most serious violations of international law. And they've brought these claims in a court in the Southern District of New York under a law from 1789 known as the Alien Tort Statute. And this law allows non-U.S. citizens to come into a U.S. federal court and assert violations of the law of nations or international law. And that's exactly what these plaintiffs have done. And we are hopeful that their case will be able to move forward. Clearly, right now, the Supreme Court is grappling with some serious questions of the scope and application of the ATS.
Katie, this case was argued last year, and now it's been argued again this year. And also, can you talk about the history of the center on this issue? And this was a key precedent that the center established in 1980. But let's first talk about the fact that it was argued again. It's very unusual for a court to hear an argument, the Supreme Court, and then say, we want to hear you guys argue again. What happened?
Certainly, it's unusual, and a recent precedent for this is Citizens United. What happened is the Second Circuit had ruled that corporations could not be held liable for these egregious human rights violations under the Alien Tort Statute. And the question of corporate liability is what went up to the Supreme Court first. They had briefing in late 2011 and heard argument at the end of February 2012.
Let me stop you for a second there, Katie. So in other words, if there's somebody in Nigeria who slaughters 10,000 people, that person, at least as of last year, there was no question that the U.S. courts could, in the right circumstances, have jurisdiction over a lawsuit against that mass murderer or genocidaire or whatever. But there was a question about corporations. Do I have it right?
Yes. And in fact, there hadn't really been a question about corporations. As you mentioned, the Center for Constitutional Rights reinvigorated this statute in the context of human rights cases in 1980. And in the following three decades, there have been a number of cases and a number of successful settlements against corporations, including cases in the Second Circuit. But we had two judges from a three-bench panel in the Second Circuit suddenly come out in the fall of 2009 and say that there is no corporate liability. So that is the question that went up to the Supreme Court. I should point out that four other circuits have looked at this question. They have all decided that, yes, of course, a corporation can be held as liable as an individual, a natural person, for such serious conduct. And there's no reason to give some kind of immunity or pass to corporations. They have rights. They also should have responsibilities.
Can you explain why the Second Circuit said there could be no corporate liability?
Well, the Second Circuit took a very, very narrow look at this question, and they essentially looked to see whether international criminal law, and specifically international criminal tribunals, had held corporations liable. Now, the Alien Tort Statute allows for a civil suit and civil liability rather than criminal liability, so it was odd to look only to criminal law and also to look at tribunals, which have, by definition, limited jurisdiction. They are by no means the entire scope of what international law says. So had the Second Circuit looked to general principles of law, where corporations every day around this globe are held accountable in civil actions for their violations of far lesser rules of law than the prohibition of torture or genocide, had they looked to the standard practice of corporate liability, they certainly would have found that corporations can be held liable for their actions.
Katie, so it went up last year on this question of could corporations be held liable really in the same way as people? And the court, after hearing that argument, put it over again. But then the issue seemed to have gotten broadened out, not just could corporations be held liable, but something about overseas. What was going on?
Right. And that second question that the court asked actually was foreshadowed immediately in the oral argument in February when Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy asked questions about why a case having to do with violations that occurred in Nigeria against Nigerian citizens with companies that are headquartered in the UK and the Netherlands, what was this case doing in U.S. courts? So it raised a question of whether it was improper to extend the alien tort statute to actions that occur in a foreign sovereign state, you know, in another country, whether we were somehow interfering with operations in other countries.
Not just having to do with corporations, then. It could also mean that they were looking at whether we could sue individuals in other countries?
Certainly. The question was framed very, very broadly. And the key case from 1980 that CCR brought, the case of Filartica versus Peñarola, you know, this case, which the Supreme Court in, as recently as 2004 affirmed as being on solid legal basis, this case involved claims by a Paraguayan against a Paraguayan for actions that occurred in Paraguay. So very strange that suddenly the Supreme Court was asking in a very broad fashion whether the ATS, the Alien Tort Statute, could apply to actions that occurred in another country. That is what the bulk of the cases brought under the ATS have been about.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the bulk of the cases. How often is the ATS used in legal arguments?
Sure. You know, one of the arguments that defendants, particularly the corporate defendants, make is what a floodgates issue it will be if the ATS is able to be used against corporations and able to be used anywhere around the world. And quite honestly, it's not that there have been thousands and thousands of cases. There have been a relatively small number of cases in the last 30 years, I'd say, maybe about 100, 150 cases where there has really been some serious grappling with the allegations. But the cases where the ATS is used are for some of the most serious violations. Again, the initial case, the Filartica case, was about torture leading to murder in Paraguay. We had cases brought in the 1990s. Against Radovan Karadzic, you know, the self-proclaimed president of the Republic of Srpska, for rape, forcible transfer, torture in the Balkans during the horrible civil war that happened there. We have cases that have been brought against UNICAL for forced labor and sexual violence in the context of building a pipeline in Burma. We already had a successful settlement against Shell for the killing of Kansar Wiwa and other activists in Nigeria. We at CCR had a successful settlement in the case against Blackwater for the shooting at Nisour Square. So the kinds of cases that have been brought under the ATS, again, are cases of war crimes, of crimes against humanity, of torture. They are not your run-of-the-mill case, but they are providing an avenue for redress when many of these plaintiffs would not have another courtroom to go to, another venue to bring their claim.
In a minute, we're going to move on to your next case having to do with the Spanish prosecutions of the Guantanamo torturers. But can you just give us a sense of how you thought the argument went last week and if you have any predictions?
Well, what's interesting when you read the transcript, first of all, there were almost no questions and no discussion on this issue from February, whether corporations can be held liable. And what I take away from that is that there at least must be a majority in agreement that corporations can be held liable. On the question of extraterritorial jurisdiction, meaning whether the Alien Tort Statute can be used for crimes that occur in another country, the justices, including the key justice, Justice Kennedy, seem to be grappling with how to draw a line. You know, is it whether the defendant is foreign versus American? Is it whether it's a violation like torture versus some others? Does there have to be some strong nexus to the U.S.? And it didn't seem like they were satisfied with any of the kind of categorical carve-outs that were coming through. What the justices seemed to coalesce around instead was the issue of whether there is an alternate forum. So if the claims against Shell could have been brought in the UK or in the Netherlands, you know, maybe they don't need to be brought in the US. If that's the outcome of exhausting another forum, either the domestic forum or the forum of the defendant, I see that as a pretty, you know, close to a win here, because that means that the U.S. can continue to be a place for victims of egregious violations who have nowhere else to go. You know, we've seen a trend over the last 20 years of other countries adopting stronger laws that allow for redress and accountability. So we don't have to be the world's policeman. There are other places that can help in ensuring there's accountability. So if the outcome is let other countries deal with, you know, defendants from there, then I think that that's pretty close again to a win.
I would agree, Katie. From what I know about this, we already sort of apply that rule in the litigation, which is we really say, well, you can bring it in that country, but if that country's judicial system is not fair, then you can bring it in the United States. So I would agree with you that I think that would be a win. But it'll be really interesting to see. It'll take you how many months for this case to be decided, do you think?
You know, it seems that the justices have obviously been thinking about this. They had very, very pointed questions. So rather than a late June outcome, we might be looking at something more in the late winter, I'm hoping, because there are many courts around the country that have put ATS cases on hold, awaiting the outcome of the Supreme Court's decision in Kiobel. So I'm hoping it will be earlier in 2013.
So now, Katie, let's move you to Spain. Spain is a case where the center and other groups have been litigating for a long time around holding U.S. torturers accountable, particularly people who were involved in Guantanamo torture. Can you give us an update of what's going on in Spain?
Sure. So there have been two cases in the last about 4 years that have percolated up in Spain. The first is a widespread investigation into the torture program opened by then-Judge Balthazar Garzón. And this is a case that's looking at torture in Guantanamo, potentially in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's looking at the whole U.S. torture program. That case was brought on behalf of four named plaintiffs. It is potentially very wide-ranging in that it's not targeting specific defendants, but it's willing to go up the chain of command as far as the evidence leads. That case is still open, but unfortunately it's moving at a very slow pace. We had submitted a request to have former Guantanamo commander Jeffrey Miller subpoenaed, and that request has been pending for quite a while. There is a second case that was brought against specific U.S. individuals, and they're known as the Bush Six. These were six men, including Jay Bybee, John Yoo, David Addington, Alberto Gonzalez, six men who served as lawyers in the Bush administration and have been argued to have essentially created both the legal structure that enabled the torture program as well as providing arguments for immunity and otherwise protecting participants of the torture program from any kind of accountability. That case is before a judge named Judge Eloy Velasco. And Judge Velasco indicated pretty early on that he was not so comfortable having this case in a Spanish court. He reached out to the U.S. government on numerous occasions over about a two-year period, essentially imploring the U.S. to tell him that there was an ongoing investigation or enough happening in the U.S. that he should defer jurisdiction, close his investigation and send it back to the U.S.
The second case, why is that before the Spanish Supreme Court?
Okay, because what Judge Velasco in this Bush 6 case did, once he finally got a submission from the U.S. government that set forward in very arguably vague ways the various investigations that have gone on over the last few years, whether it's in Congress or in the military, Judge Velasco decided that there was room for accountability in the U.S. and there was potential action against these six individuals, so he closed the case. What we have done, the plaintiffs have filed an appeal up to the Supreme Court in Spain, and that's pending right now. And just last week, we filed an amicus brief setting out for the Spanish Supreme Court why it is that it needs to continue to investigate this case, why the Spanish courts are needed. we laid out arguments about the failure in the U.S. to investigate and prosecute high-level officials for the torture program, and specifically the way that Eric Holder essentially gave immunity to anyone who relied on the lawyers' torture memos, and that would include, of course, the torture memos drafters themselves, people like John Yoo and Jay Bybee.
What's the sentiment in Spain about these cases among the public? Have they received any media coverage?
They have received sporadic media coverage over the years. And, you know, Spain has a long and proud history of upholding international law. Spain is where we had the case against Augusto Pinochet in the late 90s. So I do think there is a fair amount of support for what's known as universal jurisdiction. We did see through the WikiLeaks cables that there has been a lot of pressure exerted on members of the legal community and members of the political community in Spain, politicians, by the U.S. government under the Obama administration. That certainly received a lot of attention and a lot of negative attention. But we're hopeful that the Spanish court, when it sees that people, including former General Tacuba, have signed on to this amicus brief, that we've had former special rapporteurs on torture signing on to this amicus brief and saying, Spain, we need you to step in, that it will in fact do so.
And I'm curious, what kind of weight do amicus briefs hold in Spain? I know in the United States sometimes they can be important, sometimes not.
They're not quite as common as we have here in the U.S., but I think, again, especially when we have, we also have the former chief prosecutor of Guantanamo, Davis, who signed on to this amicus brief. When the court sees people both from the U.S. and from the international community, we had pretty much every large human rights group that also signed on to this. When it sees that kind of coalescing around a call for accountability, we're hopeful that it will have some difference.
What kind of time frame are we talking about here? I think earlier you mentioned it's proceeding slowly.
Well, the
that reminds me, Kitty, when do you go on Social Security?
Because we'll keep doing
even though you're young, I think there's a good chance you might be on Social Security.
Yeah, now we'll be doing this for as long as we need, but and until we have accountability, it's really critical. But, you know, what I said was going slowly was the case that Judge Garzón had opened, which has now been transferred to another judge. So that's the first investigation. The one before the Supreme Court, it's hard to predict how quickly it will move. The timing in Spain seems to be somewhat stop and start, as opposed to here in the U.S., where we often have more clearer deadlines. But again, you know, this is a case that was initiated back in 2009. So we're hoping that it won't be too long before we have an outcome, and of course that the outcome is a positive one.
Well, Katie, it's as usual a pleasure to have you on. We really appreciate these updates. We look forward to hearing from you, hopefully with some positive developments.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for having
me. Katie,
thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.
We'll be right back.